voters say that to me. But it really is the economy and how inflation has really siphoned off any advantages that working class people from all backgrounds have been trying so hard to change their material conditions, but they have not been able to get ahead.
And why haven't you made an endorsement?
I'm doing other work right now. You know, my one endorsement is not as important as the endorsement of voters all across this country. And I think sometimes people tend to put themselves ahead of what everyday voters need and want in this country. And so it is important to give the depth and the breadth to the voters. I am not on anybody's campaign trail. I was feeling it deeply in 2016 and 2020. And quite frankly, right now, I am not feeling it. And I am fed up. And I want it to be a clear, unattached voice for the struggles of working class people in this country from all identities, and to be able to channel their pain freely without, you know, being trying to be controlled, which I cannot be controlled. And so it was important for me to be a free agent, so to speak, during this election cycle. And that is exactly what I'm doing with my organization and also being a senior fellow at the Institute on Race, Power and Political Economy.
At the New School. We want to thank you very much for being with us, former Ohio State Senator Nina Turner. Tune in election night, Tuesday, November 5th, for a four-hour election special here on Democracy Now! I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Bye-bye.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a group of Oregon teachers prepare to strike in the next week and a half. Juveniles convicted of crime still have voting rights in Washington state. And a Pacific Northwest congresswoman describes her election countdown traveling to multiple swing states. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 31st, 2024. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us tonight. Some young people who are in Washington State's juvenile justice system could have the opportunity to vote in this year's election. Eric Tegedoff explains.
Young people locked up in Washington State Department of Children, Youth, and Families juvenile rehabilitation community facilities who are voting age and won't be transferred to Department of Corrections facilities at age 25 are eligible to vote. The organization Free the Vote Washington has been registering people to vote in these facilities, including Kelly Olson with the organization Civil Survival. She talks about convincing young people why they should vote.
The fact that just about everybody that had anything to say about them being inside that facility is from an elected position, right? The prosecutor, the judge, the legislators that made the laws that they broke, that put them there.
Olson says Free the Vote Washington educated people in the facilities on historic efforts to disenfranchise voters, especially people of color and people who are incarcerated. People who have juvenile convictions and misdemeanors retain their right to vote in Washington state. Olson says the biggest barrier is coordinating the voter registration drives, which have to include staff at the facilities despite the fact that many juvenile facilities face staffing issues. She says resources for looking into candidates and measures on the ballot can also be hard.
Unfortunately, they have limited access to internet and other types of ways that you might research somebody, so they are limited a little bit. So we did also recommend maybe talk to their family and talk to other people, but to really review the voter guide.
Olson says some young people in juvenile facilities had the chance to go to Olympia this year to advocate for a bill that could reduce lengthy sentences for juvenile offenses in some cases. She says that has also motivated some of them to vote.
Understanding that being able to convince these legislators about their bill, that have them more interested as well, I think just getting them engaged in the process is a big part of getting them interested in voting.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Greater Albany Education Association in Oregon has voted to strike in as soon as 10 days if they can't reach an agreement on a new contract with their public school district. Isabel Charlet reports.
After 9 months of bargaining, 92% of nearly 500 union members voted in favor of a strike, which would be the first teacher strike in Albany since 1987. Union President Dana Lovejoy, who's been in the district for 19 years, notes that Albany teacher salaries are currently the lowest among 35 comparable Oregon districts, which she says affects staff recruitment, retention, and classroom safety.
34 other districts get paid more than we do. So people just genuinely cannot afford to stay in this district.
The district says it's disappointed about the strike potential and that it would not be able to meet the pay increases, class size limits, and staff retention strategies the union is asking for. The union counters by pointing to the district's $15 million surplus, which it says is much higher than needed. The school district's current salary offer would move Albany teacher pay up to 32nd out of 35 comparable Oregon school districts. Lovejoy says the district has yet to respond to 10 of the union's proposals. She adds the money is there, but thinks the district needs to reassess its goals.
We know that a budget is the district's priorities, so we believe that they could reprioritize and put students first, followed by the staff who are in front of them.
One more mediation session has been scheduled, but Lovejoy says the union has requested additional meetings to address class size limits, workload, and healthcare. A strike could begin as soon as November 12th. While Lovejoy hopes a walkout won't be necessary, she emphasizes the union will stand firm for the sake of the students.
And I think it's important that our community knows that we are fighting for the schools that their children deserve.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
A Washington congresswoman urged education labor leaders in the Pacific Northwest to leave nothing on the table with just days left before the presidential election. Pramila Jayapal, who leads a progressive caucus in Congress, told union members she's been working hard bringing a message to the swing states.
I came to this country at 16 years old by myself for college with nothing in my pocket. And now I have the honor to be the first South Asian American woman in the United States House and to be one of only 25 immigrants to serve, naturalized citizens to serve in the United States Congress. When I think about this election, and I've been going across the country to every swing state, I also run a year-round organizing program out of my campaign, so our volunteers are doing phone banks twice a week into swing states. We've made over 60,000 calls just in the last 4 weeks. I just came back from Michigan and Wisconsin. I was in Pennsylvania the weekend before and Georgia the weekend before that, a couple times actually. I met with students on the UW-Madison campus. This is our organizing moment to make sure that we are putting into place a Congress with Democrats in charge in the House. Now, I know from going to campuses that there are a lot of places where young people are feeling frustrated, are feeling discouraged, maybe have disagreements with the candidates. I certainly do. I think everyone knows I've been pretty outspoken about some of my views, and they don't exactly match all of the candidates that are on the ballot and are presidential and vice presidential. And yet, I still have no doubt in my mind that they are the absolute best people for this time. And what I have been saying to people across the country is perfection is rarely on the ballot. Real progress absolutely is. And it is our job to make sure that people understand what the stakes are. Our power is in our vote. Our power is in our voice. And when we are in these last stages of this campaign with just 9 days to go, turnout matters. I was just with Gwen Walls in Michigan. We want to turn them out in Wisconsin. We want to turn them out everywhere. This is the most critical moment of our time, and we cannot leave anything on the table. So that on November 6th, We are not saying to ourselves, I wish I'd made another phone call. I wish I'd knocked on another door. We are filled with joy, with elation, with determination, with hope, with possibility about getting the things done that are on our collective agenda. And I want to thank you for being the champions you are for freedom, for justice, and for democracy. Let's get it done.
And that was Washington Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. Portland City Council considered a resolution today to extend the contract with Downtown Clean and Safe for another 10 years. Downtown Clean and Safe is a nonprofit that provides cleaning, private security, marketing, and other services to a 213-block swath of downtown Portland. The nonprofit is managed by the Portland Metro Chamber, formerly the Portland Business Alliance. It's one of the city's enhanced service districts. A city auditor report released this week says Portland has done almost no oversight of these districts and that their actions could criminalize homelessness. Earlier this year, Street Roots reported on City Council approving changes to the program amidst criticism of it. Reporter Jeremiah Hayden spoke about the issue with KBOO's Althea Billings on KBOO News In Depth.
That contract that brings all of these services into that neighborhood is managed by the Portland Business Alliance. The contract, the fees that residents within that area pay, go straight to the City of Portland. The City of Portland contracts with the PBA, and the PBA manages the contract with Downtown Clean and Safe.
Like you mentioned, within the districts, businesses, nonprofits, and individual homeowners have to pay into the program. But because it is run by the PBA, by the Portland Business Alliance, it doesn't necessarily mean that they get to have a say in or even really a clear picture of where their money goes. How have folks been pushing back on that aspect? What are some of the things that they're worried about?
This is the central point of this thing, which is that enhanced service districts were created in the 1980s. By like 1988, the City of Portland adopted. It was an early adopter of this idea. And people that live within those boundaries are required, it's not a tax, specifically written to not be a tax, but they're required to pay into this fund to get these services. The Portland Business Alliance runs this contract, and that is an exclusive, it's a 501c6, so that's like trade unions, Elks Lodge, like that kind of thing. They are not subject to any sort of government sort of transparency laws. Same with Downtown Clean and Safe, which is a 501c3, but that shares a lot of membership between Portland Business Alliance, who actively lobbies on sort of its own behalf, it says on behalf of businesses and residents, and Downtown Clean and Safe. So the transparency issue seems to be a big one because people are paying significant amounts of money into this thing, but they're not able to move the needle on where the funding actually goes. I do think that it's important to point out that the Downtown Clean and Safe one that they operate has an annual budget of $8.37 million. That's a projected budget for 2026. It's close to that right now. The Lloyd, for transparency here, the Lloyd District has a $750,000 budget, and the Central East Side together has $1.5 million budget. So they're making significantly more money off of this than any of the other ones.
And that was Street Roots reporter Jeremiah Hayden speaking with us earlier this year on KBOO News In Depth. The Portland City Council is deciding on an early renewal of the contract they have done with Downtown Clean and Safe and the Portland Metro Chamber. Some have criticized the move by the council since its days before an election, where four of them are vying for a new seat in the new city government, and the new contract would last 10 years. As police and the FBI try to find a suspected arsonist in the cases of two burned ballot boxes in Vancouver and one in Portland, the incidents have captured attention across the country, especially from lawyers who specialize in voting and civil rights. This week, Nora Benavides, Free Press Director of Digital Justice, and Heidi Benrick, the founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, described what's at stake.
And communities are preparing for November 5th, but there is a rising climate of intensity and, for some, anxiety. And we will consider the possibility of violence, credible violence, in the days and weeks surrounding November 5th. I want to start with the issue of ballot drop-off sites and the fires that we've seen in a few places. I spoke with students in Washington State. We've seen these drop-off sites in Oregon be lit on fire. There have been various reports that domestic extremists are planning their drop-off site burn plans throughout the next several weeks, and particularly in the next 6 days. Heidi, what does this do to voters? And I know you've studied the voter intimidation, fear.
This is the one area where I think there have been very troubling things happening. The boxes that were burned in Oregon and Washington had incendiary devices placed inside of them, which is a very dangerous situation. Of course, ballots were destroyed in the Vancouver, Washington instance. This is the result of the intense demonization of drop boxes by the election denial movement. This wasn't even something that was discussed before 2020 in these ways. Now, every single one of these groups goes on and on about the drop boxes in particular being a perversion of the vote. So I wasn't surprised to see those kinds of destruction of boxes. They were surveilled back in 2020 as well. True the Vote, which is one of the biggest election denying organizations, has the intention of creating what they call a reality TV show where they're going to put AI cameras on ballot boxes and have sheriffs standing there. These are real intimidation actions, and they could have an effect on people's willingness to vote.
Sidney Morrison is a longtime political history teacher, author, and former president of the Association of California School Administrators. He's written and published a book about Frederick Douglass, the famous abolitionist. After next week's election, the Oregon Historical Society is bringing Morrison in for a speaking event next Thursday night, November 7th, about the politics and culture of the current day.
I'm pleased that the novel was published this year because it speaks to our moment. And sadly, this moment has come after years of struggle where the vision of an America of diversity and inclusion has been present but constantly being attacked. And every once in a while, the history of the United States, the American people have been forced to decide what kind of country are we? Are we a country that can say that we are free and yet we support an institution of slavery? And he denounced that contradiction in one of probably his most famous speech, which is what is July 4th to the American slave? And when he gave the speech, he called out the hypocrisy and the contradictions of a country celebrating freedom, but not including everyone in that vision of freedom. And I see the same thing happening today. Although slavery is gone, many of the issues that come that resulted from slavery still exist. And he fought not only the institution of slavery, but discrimination of all kinds. Of discrimination and the mistreatment of Black people, but all people. He was one of the foremost proponents of the equality of men and women. He said famously, right is of no sex. And he's one of the first people to proclaim this in a newspaper, and was the only Black man attending the first women's rights convention in Seneca Falls in 1848. So because he insisted on these equalities, he found himself in a great deal of difficulty. He was mobbed, he was attacked, he was insulted. Eggs were thrown at him, tomatoes, but he would not stop. He would deliberately walk into restaurants knowing that he would be prevented from entering. He would go into hotels knowing that it would be the same. He was shocked to discover when he escaped from Baltimore that in the free, quote unquote, free North, he still could not go into libraries and stores because he was Black. And so he was very disappointed that his vision of freedom was limited by reality, but his dream of possibility stirred him on in ways that were so courageous. And we need that kind of courage now, whereas people will stand up and say, wait, no, this is a country that has its flaws, but this is my country. Many people in that time thought that the solution to this problem of race was immigration out of the country. It was called the colonization movement. Even Lincoln supported it until 1864. And it was a movement that said, the problems for white people can be resolved if Black people just simply left the country. South America, the islands, Africa. And he said, no, we are Americans and we are not leaving. People do not leave. He loved America deeply, even though America didn't love him back. But he believed in the dream of the possibilities of America. And I think that's what's at stake today. When you compare what is happening politically and the vision of America, one is, I believe, a vision of uniformity, a vision of authoritarianism, is a vision of there are the right Americans, the true Americans, and there's the un-Americans. And unfortunately, one political party at this point has defined Americans, the true Americans, as white, Christian, heterosexual, and with religion very intermingled into government policy to the point that separation of church and state is just non-existent. And contrary to that is a party that has, and this is ironically, I think, what Douglas would be very disappointing, because the Republican Party of Lincoln was the Republican Party of abolition of slavery and the inclusion of Black people in the vote and civil rights. And that changed historically. But he saw the Democratic Party as a party of secession and treason and segregation and Jim Crow. And so he consistently stayed committed to the Republican Party, even when the Republican Party abandoned the Black people during the Reconstruction, during after Reconstruction, after in the late 70s and 80s. And he would be very disappointed in what the Republican Party has become. But I think he would embrace what the Democratic Party, which was for him the party of treason and secession, that has become over time the party of inclusion, the party of civil rights, based on the work of people, politicians and others. Now, would he have anything to say about our current moment? Absolutely, because he was someone who was in the habit of speaking his mind and getting in trouble for it. There was a very famous meeting where he met with a group of other Black men with President Andrew Johnson in the White House, where he essentially respectfully argued with Andrew Johnson over his vision of America. And Johnson never forgave him for having the audacity to say that Americans, the Black people, should have the vote. And Johnson said, white people are against that. And people should have the right to decide who gets the vote. And he said, no, this is a human right. This is a right, not only is a human right, it's a constitutional right. As he would, I think, be one of the loudest voices today speaking about the moment. And because he was quite gifted with language, and he was quite forceful. He was a public speaker in high demand, and he'd be on the circuit going around and talking about the issues today. He would be disappointed that we're still arguing over the issue of what is America and who is included in the American vision. But I think he would be very much in tune with that, with the movement that says that this should be a nation of inclusion and diversity.
Just this week, I've been doing stories about some arsonists attacking ballot boxes in our area. And it's happened 3 times this month.
I think one of the measures of our time is that whenever I have been voting since the 1960s, and in every presidential election, I have been happy and times disappointed. But never, ever did I ever think that the nation was at risk if someone who I didn't vote for would win and the nation would be threatened, essentially, in its constitutional framework. Until now, honestly, I can say now, because before I was disappointed, but I never questioned the commitment of the presidents who won, that of their commitment to the constitutional order and the peaceful transfer of power. And now we are living in a time where the ballot box is constantly being attacked physically, and the system of elections is being judged as suspicious and unreliable. And I never thought that way. I was always confident the votes would be counted and that whoever won would win and the country would move on. And now the whole constitutional order is under attack.
Next Thursday, just 2 days after Election Day, the Oregon Historical Society is hosting Sidney Morrison,
for a talk about the links between history and the politics and culture of today. At the event in Portland on the night of November 7th, Morrison will also talk about his new historical fiction novel about the civil rights leader Frederick Douglass. Donald Trump responds to the latest garbage comment controversy. Hispanic Americans are outraged by insults about Puerto Rico, and climate smart technology could be a key election issue. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2024 Talks.
My response to Joe and Kamala is very simple. You can't lead America if you don't love Americans.
Former President Donald Trump says he's standing up for his supporters after President Joe Biden called them garbage. Seeking to clarify a comment to voting rights group Voto Latino, Biden said his use of the word was a reference to comedian Tony Hinchcliffe calling Puerto Rico an island of garbage at Trump's Sunday rally. Less than a week before Election Day, Republicans are condemning Biden's comments as an unpresidential attack on half the country. Karine Jean-Pierre is the White House press secretary.
It doesn't matter if you live in a red state. It doesn't matter if you live in a blue state. He has said this himself. I have said it on his behalf. He believes that he's a president for all.
Democrats charge Trump supporters are trying to change the subject from the toxic rhetoric at the former president's Madison Square Garden event, which has enraged Latino and immigrant rights organizations. Barbara Lopez with Make the Road Connecticut says those comments aren't just false, they're dangerous.
Immigrants, including Latinos, contribute every day to the growth, resilience, and richness of this country. Yet time and time again, we see politicians like Trump use fear as a tactic of division and for their political gain, targeting our communities with hate and violence.
Meanwhile, Florida is expecting high voter turnout, and election officials say they're overcoming damage from Hurricanes Helene and Milton to be ready. Nearly a third of the county's adjusted polling places, ballot drop boxes, and vote-by-mail procedures. Dave Ramba leads Florida Supervisors of Elections Association.
We worked with the governor's office on individual counties, both on relocating some polling places inside the deadline that currently exists in law, but also allowing for some extension of time for early voting.
The Supreme Court will let Virginia purge 1,600 voters whose citizenship is in question from voter rolls. A lower court ruled many were actual citizens who made paperwork errors, and the purge is too close to the election. Non-citizen registration and voting are extremely rare. A Georgia cleanup just found 20 non-citizens out of 8 million names. Critics of Project 2025 say it'll raise energy costs for consumers by undoing marquee Biden investments in renewables. They say the right-wing roadmap for a second Trump term would cost Nevada households an extra $230 a year by 2030. Stephen Lassiter builds solar arrays in Las Vegas and says Nevada residents are proud to lead on renewables.
The federal policies that support solar energy development have been a key backbone and driver to help Nevada achieve that milestone. Taking away those policies would potentially, for that reason, hurt Nevada more than any other state.
Trump has also promised to undo support for electric vehicles and falsely claims that Vice President Kamala Harris would force people to switch. But Kate Kruk with the New York State Capital District Electric Vehicle Association says dramatically lower fuel costs mean that transition is baked in, no matter who wins.
The ship has sailed, and I think we're ready to move forward, especially knowing that the United States can be and should be a leader in e-mobility and technology.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
A Navajo family in Arizona cast their votes after a five-day horseback ride. And Native sports teach teamwork, cooperative respect, and survival skills. For these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Four generations of a Navajo family led a five-day horseback ride recently to the Navajo capital of Window Rock, Arizona, to register new voters. It's the second presidential election that the group, known as Protect the Sacred, has worked to increase participation on the vast reservation where residents often face barriers to voting. KNAU's Richard Davis has more.
Lucinda Young and her son Latham are the first to unload their horses from their trailer alongside Highway 264. The group's ridden 45 miles through seven Diné communities. For Lucinda, this trail ride continues her family's legacy of civic engagement.
My mother used to campaign and donate a sheep, prepare it for meals, and serve voters. In remembrance of her, it's important to continue to carry that tradition to promote voting. Our forefathers, grandmothers, once they were given the ability to vote, they rode to the polls.
Lucinda's brother Frank trots by on his horse. The ride was his idea ahead of the 2020 election, in which natives were critical to President Joe Biden's narrow Arizona victory.
Our ancestors fought for our sovereignty. We want to let them know that we're still here fighting for something sacred to them. And through the horse, We're going to protect that sacred.
Frank's daughter, Allie Young, runs the nonpartisan Protect the Sacred. During this ride, they verified or updated the voter registration status of upwards of 400 Diné citizens. Arizona law requires proof of U.S. citizenship for voter registration.
That it is truly disrespectful, a slap in the face, to ask indigenous peoples to prove their citizenship in 2024 in our own ancestral homelands. We were here first. They're on the wrong side of history. The native vote is stronger. The momentum's a building.
As restless horses stop, Allie's grandfather, champion bull rider Stanley, blesses the group before they saddle up to begin their descent alongside the highway into town. Honks of support sound as the group canters toward Window Rock. I'm Richard Davis.
Traditional games are being revived in places like South Dakota, where they teach kids a range of lessons, from cooperation to native language. More from Kathleen Shannon.
Jeremy Red Eagle is a member of the Sistem Wahpeton Oyate of the Lake Traverse Reservation and is leading a movement to revive traditional games in Native communities. Sports that come from Native people, including lacrosse and archery, Red Eagle says, teach teamwork, cooperation, respect, and historically, survival skills.
Our people lived off of the land. We lived according to natural law. Physically, mentally, emotionally, we had to be strong in all of those areas of our life. And these games were a way of developing that.
After Native language, identity, and teachings were nearly eradicated during colonization, Red Eagle says games offer kids a unique way to reconnect with those aspects of culture. The games also foster connections between players and their environment, Red Eagle says. Some games require crafting supplies from natural materials.
When I work with young people, take them out, have them harvest willows or whatever it is that we're doing, we're sharing other teachings that are connected to it through the culture, the language, but you're getting them to be grounded in the land.
Red Eagle invites people of all ages to participate. He says games help bridge the generational gap. I'm Kathleen Shannon.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 31st, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Eric Tegedoff, Isabel Chalet, and Althea Billings. The producer's Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.com.